Welcome to the Arrangers Podcast. I'm Aaron Hedenstrom.
And I'm Drew Zaremba. The Arrangers Podcast is dedicated to the insightful discussion of music arranging and composition.
What we do takes a lot of hard work and resources. We are asking for support from listeners like you to continue to make this podcast available for everybody.
Please consider contributing a monthly donation to our Patreon platform. We sincerely appreciate any contributions you are able to give. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram, or leave a review on iTunes.
Be sure to send us your questions and feedback to thearrangerspodcast@gmail.com and find out more at www.thearrangerspodcast.com.
Let's dive in.
Hello, it's Jack Members.
Hello. We're excited to be here. This is a really special thing, isn't it, Aaron?
It absolutely is. We are so excited to release our first episode in partnership with the International Society of Jazz Arrangers and Composers, headed by the wonderful Chuck Owen. And it's just a real honor to have the opportunity to collaborate.
Yeah, it's just fantastic. We just did this out of fun and something to do and keep our friendship alive and have some, just do what we love doing, talking about arranging and interviewing some of our favorite arrangers and people. Little did we know that we would be had the opportunity to make this content in partnership with the best jazz arranging and composing society in the world. So we're just delighted to be here. Thank you for the partnership and the support that you are giving us, ISJAC. And to all of you, ISJAC members, thank you so much.
And as an ISJAC member, you get access to this exclusive content that we are creating in partnership with ISJAC. These episodes are not available on our normal podcast stream that's available to everyone for free. This is exclusively for you as the ISJAC membership audience. And so we're going to, you know, get into some nitty gritty stuff here, and we're excited to share it with you.
Absolutely. And on that note, we can, I think, dive right in and say that we were asked to do some episodes about some of the important, most important people to our field, and that is people who in the ISJAC Hall of Fame. And this first person is one of the most ubiquitous, and that is, of course, Duke Ellington. And to be candid, we are certainly not Duke Ellington experts. And part of the fun of preparing for this episode was doing all the research that we did, reaching out to scholars and notable composers in our field who know his music far better than us. But we're excited all the same to share with you our thoughts and impressions from his music.
That's right. And one of the amazing things about Duke Ellington's music is that it is so vast. I mean, there's such a huge library of pieces, and they range in all sorts of different settings, different orchestrations and moods, styles. And I mean, it's just hard to really put a clear category on Ellington's music, which is, I think, what's so great about it, is that it's not just, you know, taking something and just doing the same thing over and over. He was always doing something new, always exploring new territory, collaborating with new artists.
Yes.
And so that's one of the things that, you know, as we were looking into this, it's sometimes surprising to find pieces that you never even were aware existed. There's just such a treasure trove of music that is waiting to be discovered, you know?
Yeah, no doubt. And so I think without trying to cover everything, we thought it would be best to take an approach similar to the great Fred Sturm in his book, Changes Over Time. And rather than talk about a couple pieces and take deep dives on them, we're going to talk about, in general, some of his approach, his wide variety of approaches to the four following categories, and those are melody and rhythm, harmony, voicings and orchestration, and form. So combining a few things there, but that is going to be our approach. And with that, I think we're going to dive right in and start with one of the most important aspects of Duke Ellington's music, and that is his use of melody and rhythm. Let's dive in.
Since this is an episode on Duke Ellington's music, we solicited the opinions of many of our former guests and experts on Ellington's music. The first is a clip from Andy Farber on Ellington's use of melody.
Ellington's melodies are usually based upon a simple motif that's developed over the course of a piece, frequently relating to the feeling of the blues in some kind of way, and often tailored to the individual sounds and skill and qualities of Ellington's regular band members, like Johnny Hodges or Harry Carney, Lawrence Brown, Cootie Williams, you know, I could keep naming everybody that we all know, Clark Terry, Ray Nance, Jimmy Hamilton, and so on.
Thank you, Andy, for the great quote. Now, here's Drew and I's discussion on melody.
So our first category is melody and rhythm, and Drew, we decided to group melody and rhythm together. Why?
Well, for me, at least, it has to do with the fact that melody and rhythm are inextricably related to one another. The way that a melody can't exist without a rhythmic context. And so many of the rhythms, something that seems purely rhythmic in nature, has often melodies attached to it, even seemingly abstract. And so I think it's really hard to analyze these devoid of one another. And so, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why we landed there in particular. And perhaps we have a number of wonderful quotes from people that we'll be sprinkling throughout the episode. But perhaps you can share with us our own takeaways from Ellington's use of melody and rhythm.
So I would say the number one thing that jumps out to me is how emotive all of the melodies are, and I would say how much founded on the blues they are. I would say that you can't really listen to Ellington without noticing the intensity of emotion and feel and individual expression. And I think the melodies are written in a way that accommodates that and amplifies that sense of emotion. So much of it has to do with the players he's picked for his band. You know, you got Johnny Hodges and Harry Carney and Ray Nance and Tricky Sam and mm-hmm. all these wonderful players. And that's just to name a few. And the thing they all have is they all have extremely unique sounds, voices, personalities, and they play with such tangible feeling.
Yes.
And I think the thing that makes Ellington's music, you know, always speak to me, you know, when you're talking about writing music, the ensemble is the speaker for your mm-hmm. ideas. And the thing that really makes it speak to an audience is the way that everything has emotion.
Yeah. That's going to be definitely one of the overall takeaways, is just the importance of the players in the interpretation of Duke Ellington's music and how well he wrote for them. That's certainly right. Just a principal thing. You can't not talk about that when it comes to Ellington's music. Another thing that I want to hit on is just the balance in Ellington's music. A lot of it is very lyrical, very pretty, beautiful, song-like, but then there's this other side at where he really juxtaposes the lyricalness with the eccentricity of some of his melodies and rhythms, often happening at the same time as a literal juxtaposition, but then also occasionally between sections of the form. And so, and we'll have a few examples of that, but I think as a just overall, that's something also we also noticed, is just this wonderful humor and a balance of just off-kilter things. And I remember us trying to sing some things to another, you know, so
yeah,
peculiar, you know. And I think that's what keeps it consistently interesting to the listener, is this balance of lyricism and eccentricity.
Absolutely. Some of his melodies are some of the most catchy, memorable melodies
yes.
that you know you've ever heard. I mean, Mr. Saturday Night,
yeah.
you know, don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Right, yeah.
Do up, you know. I mean, those are just little earworms that'll get stuck in your head. And they're very, very listenable for a wide audience.
Yes.
Mr. Saturday Night, and they crowded the floor. It's all right.
And there's the blues right there,
so,
too. And don't mean a thing if
there,
it ain't. You know, like, there it is. There's the blues right there.
That's right. The quote-unquote blue notes, right?
Right. yeah.
So, you know, I just think, in a way, more modern expressions of, you know, the jazz art form have become a lot more complex complex melodically.
Right.
And of course, I love music that's complex melodically as well. But what's striking is that Ellington's music oftentimes is so singable and so accessible. And I think that's one of the reasons he was able to strike such a huge chord with the general public, as well as music aficionados and musicians, is because he has all of that. You know, he's got the complex melodies. Sometimes there'll be very bizarre, eccentric
yes.
Parts.
Yeah.
But then you'll also contrast that with, you know, just very beautiful, very song-like melodies. It's pretty amazing the wide range that he had. I mean, just before this, we were listening to the festival suite that Duke performed at the Newport Jazz Festival, the famous live concert. And when I was listening to that, what stuck out to me at the very end of the third movement, which is a fast up-tempo piece, it's like straight bebop. It sounds like a Dizzy Gillespie composition.
Yeah.
I don't normally think of Ellington as a bebop guy, because he definitely preceded bebop, and is more known for, you know, like we said, more melodicism or lyricism. But there we go.
Yep.
It's like a highly chromatic bebop melody. And so it just kind of, I wonder if he just kind of did it to show he could. I mean,
yeah, or it was just perfect for that situation. Who knows? I think two other observations that we have before we get into more specific examples. One is that on occasion he's really not afraid to state the obvious. There's times where he just will put the melody right there in unison, and everyone plays it, or a section of the band plays it, or just a soloist plays it, and there's not much else going on underneath. Sometimes there is, but I think just the highlighting and the importance of the melody is a defining aspect of his music. And then the second thing is that there's often a lot of space around the melodies. I think we can go ahead and get into one of the examples here, and that is one of my favorite Duke Ellington compositions, Alcupalca. And that is a very angular, strange, and yet lyrical melody with all of this space around it. It's just this, the misterioso clarinets in the Shalimo register with the accented brass that come in between at times or around them. There's all this space for Duke to make a comment or for a soloist to make a comment. And I think that is him trusting his players, that his melodies are flexible and interpretable, especially depending on who he gave them to. So that's something I really love about that particular piece, as well as several other pieces that he's written.
Yeah, the use of space in Ellington's music is fascinating because, again, as writers, I personally find it tempting to fill up all the space. You know, it almost feels like wrong or something because you feel like you
or
need
lazy.
To be, or lazy, exactly. That's exactly it. But when you, one thing I've always noticed when I play Ellington pieces is how much I sit. How much I sit between ideas. I mean, and it depends on the piece. Some pieces you play the whole time, but a lot of his pieces, you know, you're sitting for half the song before you even come in with a note. And to me, that's purposeful writing because, again, it's I have a tendency probably to just fill in space just to fill it in because I feel obligated to for some reason. But Ellington just has, it's almost like every idea, just it has to be for a purpose. And a lot of times he lets the groove just sit for a while and lets that be enough. And that really gives a lot of breathing room for the music. It doesn't feel too claustrophobic. Another really common thing in Ellington's music that I think is easy to overlook because it's so smooth sounding is that he uses a lot of chromaticism. Background parts, just like a chromatic climb of unison long tones sometimes. Or one of the things that jumped out to me as I was doing a lot of listening in preparation for this episode was this common figure he sometimes writes that goes something like, five chromatically down to the major third. Things like that where it's just it's very simple riff like figure, but it's chromatic. It's I think that's a very cool part of his music because it gives it so much melodic flavor. You know, the quote unquote rub notes are very strong in his music.
Right. Yeah. And he does the same thing with rhythm. And I think that, like, that even the way that you were singing it just now in that Hemiola fashion, at least that's what it felt like to me.
Yep, that's right.
That's also, I think that's that exact figure or something similar to it is in something you noticed in the New Orleans suite, the portrait of Louis Armstrong. Isn't that right?
Yeah, there's a melodic figure in that piece. That's one of my favorite pieces. I played that when I was in high school, and there's a little riff in the saxophones that's very angular, and it's just out of nowhere, just kind of jumpy, jolty, and it's not the whole piece. I mean, a lot of the stuff in that piece is not that angular, but it's just like all of a sudden there's like this really colorful kind of bizarre figure. But yet, when you listen to it, if you weren't paying attention, you might not even notice that it was really that weird at all because it just feels natural.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so he had a way of writing. Like, if you sit down and look at some of the stuff, you're like, huh, that is kind of weird just looking at it on paper or trying to play it and make it sound good as a band. But when you listen to it, it all sounds very very natural.
Something else we noticed was just how not only he would develop motives in his music from piece within a piece, but then he would also on occasion repurpose melodies for new contexts. The classic example is the link between Concerto for Cootie and Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me.
Do nothing till you hear from me. Pay no attention to what's said.
And then another one that you noticed, Aaron, was Come Sunday, and then David Dance Before the Lord. I forget who that was featuring, the dancer, the tap dancer that was featuring.
Oh, yeah. Ellington's sacred music that
yes.
featured the tap dancer Bunny Briggs.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Afraid to use old melodies for new contexts.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
Because obviously Come Sunday is hymn spiritual-esque, and David Dance Before the Lord is has a fast beat to it. But much like they do in cinema and programmatic music, I mean, not just programmatic music, but in music that serves a wider context in media, you'll use the same theme in order to tie things together. That's certainly what's going on there.
yep.
And that just shows what a much bigger vision Duke has for his music than just that was that melody and it'll just stay there. It has greater context.
Absolutely. So we could obviously go on and on about Ellington's melodies. You could write an entire encyclopedia or an entire dissertation, 500 pages about that. But it's easy to focus on harmony because it's such a vast world and it's such a such an important thing. If you get the harmony wrong, it sticks out like a sore thumb. But again, melody is kind of the great equalizer, where if you have a great melody, it will always triumph over great harmony. So I would say harmonically, Duke Ellington had quite a wide range. You have very straightforward, very functional harmony progressions in his music. He has so many jazz standards, In a Mellow Tone, Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, Cottontail, Take the A-Train, Satin Doll, etc., etc., etc. And many of those tunes utilize things like 2-5-1s, diatonic chord progressions, but you see a lot of alterations done to them. For example, instead of just doing a minor 2 chord, you might do the dominant 2 or the secondary dominant 5-5 if you want to put it in classical Roman numeral
Certainly.
Analysis. And those types of alterations can take a very straightforward harmonic progression and add some color and some even some blues, I would say, because you're adding chromatic tones.
Yeah. Yeah, the blue note, flat 5, sharp 11, and then like the lowered third, the flat third, and then the lowered seventh, of course, too. All of these are chromatic alterations on the normal scale. And I think what's just so, I mean, of course, all the standard stuff, it seems normal to us now, but like his harmonic approach and his and how he uses his harmonic structures in particular are kind of the bedrock of along with the rest of Tin Pan Alley tunes, but it's really the tapestry of which the jazz harmony is woven into. Like it's the bedrock, it's back then, you know, it was new and hip and interesting. And now it's like, oh, sure, you know, we take a tune like, Prelude to a Kiss, or what's another one that I was just thinking about? Sophisticated Lady, like all the different harmonic movements going to a chromatic mediant on the bridge, or different, or modulating in different parts. Like, that was really hip at the time, and it's so important to how everything was influenced from then on. And yeah, so many standards that he wrote that are used for contrafacts, that are used for the basis of other tunes. So, like, in a mellow tone, Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, Cottontail, of course, which is just rhythm changes, but Take the A Train. How many tunes are based on Take the A Train? In particular, the A right. section, in particular, the train, if you will. No pun intended there. Satin Doll, uh-huh. like Satin Doll. Wow, that's an amazing tune harmonically for its time. Those backdoor 2/5s and the tritone subs in very interesting locations. It still feels very fresh today. I have to practice Satin Doll. It's not an easy tune.
It really isn't. It's very, very nuanced and sophisticated harmonically. And it's you're right. You know, I see Ellington's music in a lot of ways like the great, you know, historical artists, you know, like, for example, I remember in high school, I asked my English teacher, what made Shakespeare so great? You know, kind of the, of course, maybe he was a little sarcastic, but what makes Shakespeare so great? And because when you read it now, it just seems so average, right. You know, it's like, it's a lot of stuff you've read before. It doesn't necessarily seem revolutionary. But that's because you're not taking into account that at the time that Ellington was writing it, it was completely new. It wasn't something that had been done before. So we have 100 years or 80 to 100 years for some of these pieces to have influenced the music that we have now. And so now a lot of these harmonies are like, hey, we've seen these 2/5s a million times. We've seen these progressions a million times. We've seen chromatic mediants a million times, or these different harmony progressions that are now very common and very repeatedly mm-hmm. used in the music we play every day. But this was done in a time where the music was in a very formative young stage. And Ellington, I think you're right, Drew. I think without Ellington's music, you know, how many of these things would we have now? I mean, it's obviously hard to say, but he was such a powerhouse in terms of creating, you know, standard tunes, standard progressions, and certainly copied, you know, widely. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. I think now would be a great time to bring in another perspective. And that is that of a great scholar of Ellington's music, and that is Andy Farber. Take it away, Andy.
Ellington's use of harmony and voicings were informed by his melodies. If all of the inner parts in a voiced-out harmonized passage are to be an interesting melody unto themselves, then very often the chord voicings, when read vertically in a score, would be unconventional. They can sound a little strange just by themselves, but in the context of the piece, it works perfectly. Many other big band arranger and composer types of the swing era and pre-swing era were sticking to pretty traditional triadic and four-part harmony in, like, mostly diatonic fashion. Ellington himself made dramatic use of triadic harmony, especially when he was writing for the trombone section, usually just at three trombones. Or the pep section, two trumpets and a trombone, with usually, you know, pixie mutes and plungers. He would usually write them in three-part, mostly triadic kind of harmony. He would often mix chromatic and diatonic harmony within the same passage. Of course, any writer of sophistication would begin doing this, you know, but Ellington does this pretty early on in our continuum.
Thank you, Andy Farber. And that is just, I remember playing Ellington's music and I'm on an inner harmony part and I think, oh, wow, this feels really melodic. I think that has a lot to do with why the music swings. If the inner parts are very melodic and it's not just a matter of avoiding repeated notes, as we're told in arranging textbooks, but it's also like, does it have melodic shape to it? Does it really feel like it's a melody? Because if it is, then it will be played with more conviction, and it will swing in a better way ensemble wise. And so I think that's what how harmony and melody are interwoven together. He's not necessarily always thinking about the vertical structure. He's thinking about the horizontal structure within the vertical structure, or sometimes not even thinking about the vertical structure. Just, okay, we're going to get there. And this had particular great influence on Gil Evans, Bob Brookmeyer, and then, of course, Maria Schneider, and so many others today. But that approach of the inner parts being really important melodies. I remember playing some Gil Evans music, and sometimes the second part would cross over the first part, and that's because that's where that melody was going, and then it eventually settled down underneath it again. But this is kind of another approach to harmony, rather than thinking about it like a block chord.
Right. And in addition to that, the harmony was oftentimes accentuated in a altered fashion simply because the melody note was an altered chord tone. And I don't know how, again, I mean, without stepping into the mind of Ellington, we don't know how he conceived of some of these things, or what, was he thinking, oh, this will be a sharp 11, or was it just, you know, something he played at the piano and felt. I don't know how, because, you know, every composer is different. And of course, I'm sure we have different terminology for some of these things than Ellington had mm-hmm. back when he was composing. But whatever he was thinking about, like a lot of times you'll have just a simple dominant chord voiced mm-hmm. in the band. And then the melody, whoever has it, has the sharp 5 or the sharp 11 or the right. flat 9. Or the sharp 9, and it's like, whether or not he had the name for it in mind that we call it nowadays with our terminology that's been more standardized, it's what it is. So, for example, Concerto for Cudi, we did a score study on this on our mm-hmm. podcast. Just a blues melody in F major. And then chromatic dominant chords below it, moving down in half steps. And just by virtue of the half step movement, you have all these chromatic chords, but then the melody is still purely in F blues, you know, F major blues scale, if you want to use those terms. Just the rub of chromatic harmonies against very straightforward in the key mm-hmm. melodies will naturally create quote-unquote, you know, blue notes or rub notes mm-hmm. or whatever you want to use to call those dissonances that make it more interesting.
Right. Before we move on, I think a couple other pieces that we really enjoyed and something that we not want to talk about is, of course, he's certainly not the first one to adapt a classical piece of music into a jazz context, but I think he did so in one of the most famous manners. Of course, the Nutcracker Suite. Which I just love when it, just
Me
the
too.
Reimagination of, and it's also beloved, of course, not only because of the source material too, but his reimagination of the Nutcracker Suite, melodically, rhythmically, but then of course harmonically, just how he took those melodies and made it work in a jazz swinging context. And how he added things here and there harmonically, and then put it in a just a totally new vibe, I think is a really a credit to his genius. I think you also mentioned the Pierre Gint suite, right, where he's reinterpreting Grieg, pieces by Grieg.
That's right. Yeah, the Norwegian composer Grieg and the Pierre Gint suite, reimagined by Ellington. It's again. That's another thing that Gil Evans and other influential arrangers have done since Ellington. Sketches of Spain. With his Concerto de Aaron Wes, and some other pieces, but it's what Ryan Truesdale called recomposition. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing. Like Drew said, the way he's able to make the melodies swing and make the harmonies, it obviously can't be that different from the original in the sense of where the music has to move, but it has to be different enough to fit the style, so... I think those are masterfully done.
Mm-hmm.
And some of his music harmonically can even venture towards slightly atonal sounds. I don't know that he ever truly went, Schoenberg on anything, but which that's fine by me. But there's a piece on his Money Jungle album called Lorette African, mm-hmm. or African Flower, mm-hmm. and it's a very haunting, beautiful piece, and it's just got some kind of exploratory, moody, chromatic harmonies that, again, they're not fully atonal, but they kind of border on atonal-ish in a way that kind of gives it a mysterious sound. Ellington is not afraid to write in the pocket harmonically, mm-hmm. but certainly, to me, he writes whatever he wants harmonically,
right.
If it has a clear label for it, then that's the case at times, but sometimes there's stuff where, it is what it is kind of chord. It's just, this is the sound of the chord, and whether that's because there was a more horizontal function that dictated the more non-conventional vertical structure, or whether it was just a really dissonant chord that has certain notes, they don't always have to have a clear name or label on them, which is part of what makes his music alluring, in my opinion, is it does venture off into pretty adventurous territory.
Yeah. I think that's a great segue on harmony. Let's move on to orchestration with also emphasis on voicings.
The following is a clip from the great Rich DeRosa, professor of jazz arranging at University of North Texas, whom Drew and I both had the opportunity to study from. Here's his thoughts on Ellington's orchestrations and voicings.
Duke Ellington's composing and arranging offers much wisdom for succeeding writers. First, he willingly embraced different perspectives. Although he is primarily thought of as a jazz composer, he brought other musical styles into the realm of the jazz band. He boldly mixed influences and sounds of instruments and often placed them in unusual or certainly less common locations. With regard to instrumentation, Mood Indigo is perhaps the simplest and most vivid example. Written in 1931, the piece followed on the heels of traditional or Dixieland jazz, where the three horns, clarinet, trumpet, and trombone, had clearly defined roles. The trumpet, placed in the mid-range, played melodies, while the clarinet, placed in the highest range, responded contrapuntally. The trombone typically functioned in the tenor range as it performed harmonic guide tones above the bass notes. In Mood Indigo, Duke drastically redefines these roles. The trombone is placed at the top and plays the melody. the clarinet is placed at the bottom to broadcast its lush, dark, shallow register, while the trumpet remains in the middle, but its role is now in harmonic support of the melody. With regard to Duke's influence on my creative process, I've learned that beyond technique, imagination and sincerity can yield more interesting music. Duke's effectiveness as a writer is also evident when we realize that he wrote not just for instruments, he wrote for the people who played them. It is in a writer's best interest to consider playing ability, style, and preferences in the performers for whom we write.
So I think as we approach the topic of orchestration, we have to come back to the band, as we said we would, as this is one of the big themes of Ellington's music, not just his wide range melodic in all categories, but then also just how critical, I think one of the biggest lessons is that you write for the band, you write for the players, because he had the ability and vulnerability to trust his musicians. He, you know, certainly, I think he wrote for the individual. He was not, although he certainly had ensemble moments and ensemble sounds, his primary thought was, how am I going to use this individual and feature them? Or, I have this melody. I need it to be highlighted. Who is the best person to do this? As much as he's thinking about an instrument, he's also thinking about the person. And so certainly modern writing can be designed, younger band writing, you know, it can be designed with lots of doubling to hide weakness. You have a weaker fourth trumpet player or third trombone player, no problem. They're being doubled in the saxophones or maybe in another brass part. But there's not a lot of doubling in Ellington's music. And that forces the individual to come out and reckon with the music. I personally think this is why one of the reasons why Wynton Marsalis with the essentially Ellington whole thing is really important, because rather than young musicians hiding within the ranks of doubling and homogeneity, they have to rise to the occasion and encounter the music on a personal level and relate to it. That is, I think, part of the legacy of the essentially Ellington program. And so I think that's a really beautiful thing about Ellington's music. You have to have an emotional and personal connection to it. Otherwise, the music simply doesn't speak or work. I know there's some provocative things in there. Maybe you can simmer the tone down, Aaron.
Well, I think, you know, like you said, I mean, in a lot of contexts, if you're writing for educational situations, oftentimes, you know, players of younger, more less experienced stature benefit from having, you know, doubled notes across the band and things like that. So none of that's wrong. It's just, as David Berger put it when I took a lesson with him, when you double a note in another instrument, you take away the personality afforded a single note. And so if you have a triad and each note is given to only one person, then that person can put their sound on it and not have to blend. But if you have multiple people on the same note, if you have five saxes on one note, that's not a bad thing by any means. It just isn't a personal expression anymore. So you see unisons in Ellington quite a bit, but what you don't see, to my knowledge, and I'm open to being wrong on this, but I would venture to guess that you'd probably not see a lot of doubled inner chord tones, unless there's probably situations where there are, but just generally speaking, you know, it's more often the case that players have their own notes to sing on, and they can put their own vibrato and their own expression on it. And that's something you just can't do if you have four other people on your note, because, you know, it's going to blend together, and you can't really put vibrato on it without clashing. And so that's one of the brilliant things about Ellington's writing, is just the way that he's, you know, he's not afraid to leave someone on an island. Here's a good analogy. In sports, you have man-to-man coverage and zone coverage, right? Man-to-man coverage is where, you know, you have a defensive player matched up one-on-one on an offensive player. And if that player is really, really good, that's going to work out. But if you need a little help, you might play zone where you have two people on one person, right? Two defensive players on offensive player. So it's kind of like that. Like when you're writing for educational scenarios, you're kind of writing in a way that's more like zone coverage. Just it's kind of like you're doing that to mitigate the weaknesses of the players because it's a younger, less experienced band. What's so cool about the Essentially Ellington is that it challenges those bands to say, instead of doing that, we're actually going to ask you to check out the recordings and do your homework and actually step out of that comfort zone and play the one note on a part.
Yeah.
Play the melodic solo that's just out there on an island, you know?
Develop your tone.
Exactly. And that's such a beautiful thing. You know, I remember in high school, I played some Essentially Ellington stuff with my school jazz band, and our entry tape to the festival got torn to shreds by, I think it was Winton that was commenting on it. But, and which is great. I mean, that's the whole point of the thing, is to learn. But, you know, it's just a lot of the comments were just tone. Like,
right.
You know, and so I just think, I remember getting clinicked on one of those pieces. I was playing lead alto on my high school jazz band, and the clinician, who was a great alto player, was saying, you know, well, I guess the only comment I really have is just be more Hodgian. And I thought, that's it right there. It's the personality. You could play the notes in tune. You could play it with a good sound, but it could be the wrong sound for the piece, you know? It's so different to have to sit down and reckon with just a melody and just play it as the melody and not fill it with a bunch of extra notes, but to really sing with a good sound, vibrato, expressiveness, and not be able to hide behind excessive notes, excessive harmonic accentuations.
And something you were talking about earlier was the virtuosic emotive qualities, in addition to the virtuosic technical qualities that Ellington's musicians had, certainly, but that's not what they were known for. They had technical, virtuosic technical qualities, but how they chose to use their abilities was more, and how I imagine how Ellington wanted them to play was with virtuosic emotion. Because to serve the music, warm, expressive sounds, it was about serving the music in that way. Bebop was about the musicians breaking free and showing their virtuosity and their dynamic creativity, but this was a different philosophy. And we should add that this certainly doesn't disqualify other composers who choose to write more blended music, or bebop, but this is an episode about Ellington, so we're going to sing his praises right now, and talk about the wonderful things that he did.
Absolutely.
And I just think it's hilarious that we've spent, I don't know how many minutes in orchestration, and we haven't even talked about orchestration yet, because we spent all this time talking about the players and their additions to the band and how the individual approaches it. But I suppose we should jump into some more quote-unquote formal orchestration topics here.
One thing that is very often talked about is the use of non-traditional, you know, voicing structures like Mood Indigo, where the trombone's on top of the clarinet, for example.
Right, of course, and the trumpet in the middle. And,
right, and so, you know, that's one of the areas I think he was very innovative in, is not just doing the most obvious orchestrational solution, but doing something that is a less obvious but oftentimes more interesting solution.
Yes, yes. And in that way, I think we can talk about his use of many other things, not just the trombone on top and the clarinet in the bottom, but his use of mutes, and how he would get so many different sounds, not just with the plunger and the pixie, but then cup mutes, and the different combinations therein. We have to talk about Harry Carney and just how he wrote for him so individually, so openly. A lot of melodies in the Barry, a lot of solo counterlines in the Barry, or sometimes even like in the middle voice. Thad uses the Barry in some really interesting ways, but not as individually. And the Barry, I remember this lesson from Rich very well, that is, the Barry is the only unique instrument in the horn section, because all other horns are doubled. You know, the trumpets are doubled, the trombones, there's several of them, there's two altos, there's two tenors, but the Barry, there's only one like it. And so that's a very, he used that in a very interesting way. And of course, then you have to talk about Duke Ellington himself and just how he used the piano, as it sometimes often is, but I think a lot of it came from him, is how he used that kind of as a reprieve for the band. You know, the horns, 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 and he would not play for a long time. And then, boom, here comes the piano, a new, fresh timbre, orchestral in nature, but so distinct and different. And, of course, it was him, you know, so he just had total freedom to do what he felt was appropriate in that moment. So...
Yeah, it's almost Basie-esque the way that he treated the piano, right? I mean, and I think that's one of the things about big band or large ensembles that piano players oftentimes comment on, is that when the whole band is playing, what am I supposed to do? Like, you know, just keep comping? Well, it's already thick enough. And it's hard to hear what I'm doing anyways. But I think when you talk about Ellington, you know, he just worked with that and he didn't fight against that idea, but would rather play to the strengths of each, you know?
Yeah. Yep. I think the last thing I want to say on orchestration is just like we said about range, in terms of melodic range and harmonic range that he had huge orchestral range. Not just between pieces, like the different orchestrations he would use, but even within a piece, he would keep rotating the colors so much. I think Alcopaca is one of them, but also Bula is another beautiful piece. Zweet Thursday is a great one, like between all the mutes and different combinations. Like, I don't think there's a texture that was ever repeated in that piece. Particularly for jazz composers, if you're coming at it from a tune writing perspective, then it's easy to stick with just one orchestration the whole way through, and that's just something Duke Ellington almost never does. It's always evolving and changing depending on what the melody needs or what's happening harmonically.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you have a lot of contrast between louds and softs, and that can touch on a little bit of what we talked about with the piano, use of piano. But, you know, you have these bombastic brass sections, and then you have just instantaneous breakdown to a rhythm section with piano, playing some high register riffs or something. So I think that's another aspect that's just really, it's very simple stuff if you just think about it, like, you know, soft and loud. But when you master those simple things, it makes your music great, like Ellington's.
Yeah, truly, truly. I think we'll go ahead and play a few of our favorite moments from some of the pieces we mentioned.
In addition to being our first ever interview on the podcast, David Berger is one of the world's foremost Ellington experts, having transcribed dozens, if not hundreds, of Ellington compositions. Here's David Berger talking about Duke Ellington's use of form.
Nearly every innovation in jazz in the last 100 years can be found a decade or two earlier in Duke Ellington's music. This is especially true in the area of form, where he mastered the New Orleans multi-strain forms, led the way into charts based on popular song chorus form, and then pioneered extended forms such as suites, tone poems, and even a jazz symphony. What separates Ellington from the rest of jazz composers and arrangers is his integration of rhythm, melody, harmony, and orchestration into forms that tell compelling stories, always utilizing the four basic elements of jazz: blues, swing, grooves, and improvisational interplay. He is living proof that great art can be, and should be, entertaining and emotionally satisfying.
Ooh, wow.
What a quote.
Oh, David Berger right there, Ellington expert, truly brilliant, truly brilliant. Let's talk about form, Aaron.
Yeah, so, I mean, as you just heard from Berger's quote, one of the hallmarks of Ellington's legacy is just the variety of forms that he experimented with and composed in. And I think that's something that really sets him apart in his era because, you know, I suspect some of this may have had to do with recording technology and the short time interval that you had to record.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the early big band pieces were, you know, maybe a couple minutes long or very much shorter form pieces. And Ellington wrote plenty, you know, short tracks, but he would also go into, you know, these big suites like the Nutcracker in, you know, Such Sweet Thunder,
mm-hmm.
The Far East Suite, and
yes.
These are just to name a few of many. You know, there's just so many ways that he utilized form to frame his ideas, and just the sheer longevity of his career in doing this has provided so many examples of diverse approaches to form that I think is extremely impressive.
Truly, truly. Another thing that he did a lot was mess with the blues. Of course, he using the melody in a blues way, harmonic-shaped blues, orchestrationally using the blues. And then, of course, with no exception, messing around with the blues in terms of form. And two of my favorite pieces, I should say, are where he does this, are two very famous ones. Jack the Bear, of course, where he's very much expanding on the blues form, messing around with different 8-bar phrases, 10-bar phrases, and vacillating between different sections of the blues. And then one of my favorites, Sepia Panorama, which is very famous because of its palindromic form, meaning it's the same in reverse as it is going in, with a middle section that is unique. And I just think that's pretty genius. I certainly don't
Absolutely.
Think about palindromes when I'm writing forms.
Yeah. Yeah, neither do I.
Right? And so I think that would be just, if you're not hip to that one, and just how flexible he is with his themes and his elements of form, I just, I love that piece in particular of Ellington's.
You know, it almost sticks out to me, it almost feels to me like you can imagine his excitement composing at the thought of a new approach to this, you know, because speaking from personal experience, when you have a fresh perspective on how to, you know, arrange or compose something, it can oftentimes spark all these new ideas. And I think when you look at the just a huge variety of ways that he uses the blues, the ways that he organizes a piece, you know, shape wise, like dynamic shapes or whatever. It's almost like, you know, how many different ways can I utilize form?
And yeah.
It must have been very enjoyable for him to see how form can impact the outcome of a piece.
Right, right. And, you know, I think now it would be a great time to let one of our friends illuminate us on this subject. We asked Darcy James Argue to talk about one of his favorite pieces of Ellington's as it relates to form and why.
Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue is a famous piece in Duke Ellington's career. It almost single-handedly revitalized his career in 1956 when he performed it at the Newport Jazz Festival, and Paul Gonsalva's amazing 27-chorus wailing interlude brought the entire audience to their feet. But this is a piece that was composed much earlier. It was composed in 1937, and it is incredibly forward-looking in terms of structure and form. This reverse arch form, starting at maximum volume and intensity and gradually dwindling down to almost nothing before roaring back up again for the grand finale, that kind of structure is really unusual in Ellington and in music in general. And particularly the way Duke accomplishes the diminuendo is fascinating to me, because of all of the formal games he plays with your expectations. It's built around the 12-bar blues, and we can all feel a 12-bar blues, but Duke likes to pull the rug out from under you every so often. Right away in the first chorus, it might be a 12-bar blues, but Duke doesn't always go back to one when we expect him to go back to one. The second chorus is actually a 10-bar blues, but it's hard to hear because the start of the third chorus is exactly the same as the start of the second chorus. And then that only lasts 4 bars as a 2-bar interlude, and then we modulate. It goes from the key of E flat to the key of G. And it actually modulates again to C and then to F minor and finally to the key of D flat, all in the course of less than 2.5 minutes. It's incredibly disorienting, and it really keeps you on your toes as a listener.
Talks about the reverse arc form. I mean, that's such a great way to put it. And Darcy's another person who's very knowledgeable about Ellington, has written some blog posts about Ellington's music that are very, very well done, very brilliant writing. So check those out.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think we should talk about one more thing. Of course, there's so much we could talk about, like you said, all the suites and all the expansion on the blues, but one thing that is really important to Ellington's music that I think is very appropriate for this time is his expression of Black identity and culture, with such pieces like Black and Tan Fantasy, Creole Love Song, Symphony in Black with Billie Holiday, which was also a film, and also all of the influences of his sacred music, much of those influences coming from the Black Church.
Absolutely. And I think if you read any biography of Ellington or learn about any of his background, so much of that music comes from a place of cultural expression. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I think many discussions are happening right now about the history of jazz originating as Black American music, mm-hmm. expressing, you know, a sense of freedom of expression after having been oppressed. I think that's such an important thing with Ellington's music. That's again, the way that he uses his players and gives them a voice, that's one of the differences between more of a classical approach, which is, you know, here's my articulations, here's the way I want you to phrase it. Instead, Ellington, you know, here's the notes, you play it, you mm-hmm. phrase it how you are going to do it. And so I think that's extremely important, something that speaks volumes about the importance of his music too, and its importance on American culture and the influence of African American music on the American culture.
Yeah, we have to say that the context really matters. That his music was a result of who he was, how he grew up, and we can't replicate his circumstances. That doesn't mean we can't write music in the style of Ellington or learn from him, but we, as we've spoken for a long time, for a few minutes now on Ellington's music, but we have to recognize where some of those influences came from, and how beautiful it is that he's now, his culture and his point of view has now influenced so many others. And so that's just something contextually I think we can all remind ourselves of, that this is a really, it's significant in that way, and significant to the national conversation that is happening in the United States right now about race, about equality, about justice, and that these were, that the music that Ellington was producing was born out of his experience as a black man in America in the first, predominantly the first half of the 20th century, moving into the second half a little bit.
Absolutely. So it is with great, you know, humility that we present this this discussion of his music, because obviously, you know, Drew and I are so, you know, we're young guys, we're far removed from the era that Ellington composed in, and so we're coming at this very much from an outside perspective, looking at his music, trying to appreciate it and honor it and give it the respect it deserves. And so you know, we're very, very honored to be able to present this music, which is obviously some of the greatest music of all time, certainly some of the greatest music of the 20th century, and something that just continues to echo today in music that is still being made.
Yes. So I guess to sum up our main points, and that is, Duke Ellington truly resisted and defied categories. He was always going something for new, going beyond his conventions. The range was just immense, melodically, harmonically, orchestrationally, and in terms of form. And I guess the other point for me is that how important his musicians were to him, and how partners in the creative process. Aaron was saying, it's not a classical top-down approach. This is a equals. Would you read this? Make this your own. Make this yours. I wrote this for you. This, you know, interpret it as such. What else? A couple other points there, Aaron, generally?
Yeah, just the focus on expression, you know, the individual voice of each musician being heard.
The blues.
The blues, absolutely. Just one of the things that I think we both kind of noticed listening to this was, there's very little in the music that's just completely neutral. Like, there's not like, oh, that was just kind of a ho-hum moment. Like, everything has, you know, everything has vitality to it, every single note. And
it really belongs.
Yes, and I think all around, I think his music, it's almost, I feel like we've only touched on like a tiny particle of the, you know, of the universe of Duke Ellington, because Like, when you really start going down that wormhole, it's going to take you a long time to get out of it.
Yes.
You know, and I can't tell you how I felt unprepared going into this, knowing that there's going to be so much ground that we can't possibly cover in just 45 minutes. I mean, you have whole people dedicating their careers to you know, documenting and studying and preserving Ellington's music. So that alone speaks volumes to how monumental and important it was. It's something that I'm personally looking forward to digging into and studying further, just because I know that I can learn so much more from it and learn so much more about it.
Same here, Aaron. Same here. And I think for all of us, with a few exceptions who might be listening, in which case, forgive us.
You know, our audience is probably made up of many people who know way more about this than we do. So
yeah,
I'm just glad to be a part of the conversation.
Likewise. Well, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Isjack, again for partnering with us to produce this episode and a few more episodes coming your way shortly. Thanks. Hope you got something out of it, and tune into. We have a lot more episodes on the website and at other places where the podcast is distributed. So if you dug this, be sure to check out a few more episodes. We'd really appreciate it. Drop us a line or anything like that. And as always, thank you for listening.
And be sure to check out all the other great content on the Isjack website. And I'm sure that everybody at Isjack would appreciate it if you also spread the word grassroots style to your friends who are musicians, who are writers, composers, arrangers, or who want to get better at that. I'm sure they would love to have new members of the community. And I'll say, after having gone to the last conference, it was an extremely satisfying experience for all of us. I think, you know, having gone to the Jazz Education Network conference a couple times, and then going to the Isjack conference, what stuck out to me is that it's a lot smaller because it's a much more niche community. So if you're thinking about going to the next conference, I would highly recommend it, because it's a great place to meet people. You know, and it's an incredibly inspiring event, getting to see different people's approaches to composition and arranging. So spread the word, go and participate in Isjack's offerings, which are numerous, and we thank you again.
Thanks all. Bye now.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Arrangers Podcast. If you enjoyed what you just heard, you can support us directly with a small donation on Patreon or by sharing this episode with a friend. You can hear lots of other interviews, score studies, and fun discussions at www.thearrangerspodcast.com or wherever you find podcasts.
Bye for now, and keep writing.